Hello and welcome to National League Town, Mets fandom, Mets history, Mets life, with Long Island's own Greg Prince and Jeff Heisen. Hey, Greg.
A stellar hello to you, Jeff.
On today's show, we try to right some all-star wrongs.
The 2023 All-Star Game coming soon to T-Mobile Park. And we, at least in theory, are pulling for various Mets to be selected to the big show in Seattle. Yet we are right now moved to recall favorites of years past who were not Met All-Stars. They might have been All-Stars in our heads or our hearts, but they were never named to an All-Star team as Mets. We are here to do something about that. We seek to right historical wrongs or perhaps attend to sentimental soft spots. We are going to name some of those Mets who missed All-Star teams as Mets, and we're going to work a few of those onto All-Star teams. This selection process is not legally binding, but we, as Mets fans, will feel a bit of Midsummer Classic justice has been done. On the National League Town retroactive All-Star ballot, we will consider five Mets at each position, including a few positions that don't show up on your standard MLB ballot, and vote somebody onto the National League All-Star team in a season when they were eligible, and anything from a decent to an airtight case could have been made for them. If they happen to be All-Stars at other stops in their careers in other years, that's swell. But we want them to be Mets All-Stars. We are looking in particular at Mets who are having great first halves, yet for whatever reason were snubbed from a particular All-Star team. Mets who were on their way to great years, but it took the second half to make that abundantly clear, so maybe they hadn't yet revealed themselves to be All-Star caliber. And Mets whose legacies live on for us, legends in our own mind, and maybe even members of the Mets Hall of Fame, yet somehow they were never recognized as All-Stars when they were Mets. We're not looking to take apart a given year's NL All-Star team and boot some player from somewhere else off, even if that might be satisfying in certain cases. This is a flight of provincial fancy, taken out of affection for all the Mets we've loved before. Ineligible for consideration will be any Met who did make at least one National League All-Star team as a Met. We might have wanted somebody who made it only once to make it multiple seasons, or somebody who made it multiple seasons to have made it every season, but that kind of Met is already taken care of. That kind of Met is already identified as a Met All-Star forever. We just want to dispense a little more of that recognition to those we deem worthy of the honor. We're also talking only about former Mets in the hope that any current Met who has not been yet named to a National League All-Star team will eventually have his name called, maybe as soon as in the coming days. I will read for Jeff the five candidates at each position on our ballot, and we will bat or toss around our impressions and memories of those players, mull over their qualifications, and then each cast our vote. The National League Town retroactive All-Star ballot was prepared with utmost care and historical perspective, but as MLB has traditionally sanctioned, if Jeff wants to offer a write-in vote, he can opt for somebody I haven't included. Or maybe I'll go rogue and vote for somebody not already on the ballot. It should be pointed out that some position groups are stacked, and some may strike you as rather thin, but we'll get into the whys and wherefores as we go along. We will present the players in each position group alphabetically. Each player nominated is attached to a year when he realistically could have or should have received an All-Star selection, but if we find ourselves swayed by the concept of a lifetime achievement pick, the way some fans will vote for players past their prime because of what they accomplish across their, yes, stellar careers, that's okay. We're fans, too. Now, we're going to vote. At first base, to join Ed Cranepool from 1965, Keith Hernandez from 1984, 1986, and 1987, and Pete Alonso from 2019 and 2022, we consider Don Clendenin, 1970, defending World Series MVP and on his way to setting the single-season club record for runs batted in. Ike Davis, 2010, electrifying rookie, not only the bat, but with three highlight reel tumbling catches over railings. Carlos Delgado, 2006, perhaps the key difference in creating the monster lineup that by mid-year is in the process of devouring the National League East. John Milner, 1974, the Hammer, about to lead the Mets in home runs for a third consecutive season. And John Olerud, 1998, batting .326 at the All-Star break with an OPS over 900, and he's just getting warmed up for his pursuit of the franchise mark for highest batting average. This is the epitome of a stacked position group. We had to leave out eventual 30 home run slugger Lucas Duda from 2014, emerging batting title contender Dave Magadan from 1990, entertaining RBI guy Willie Montañez from 1978, and a future Hall of Famer who is building his statistics in a substantial way, Eddie Murray from 1993. But the write-in option exists for our ballot, just as it did when fans like Jeff and me elected Steve Garvey in 1974, when we probably should have been good Mets fans punching holes next to the name Jay Milner. So tell me, Jeff, there are a lot of good-looking first basemen here from the Mets. What do you think?
On a previous show, I advocated for Carlos Delgado to become a Hall of Famer and a Mets Hall of Famer, but that doesn't mean he gets my vote this year. I've also said that Carlos Beltran had the greatest three consecutive seasons for a position player in Mets history. But John Olerud came close in 1997, 1998, and 1999. Perhaps the second greatest three-year run for a position player in Mets history. And 1998 is why he gets my vote on your ballot today. A 55.7 offensive war, a 5.8 defensive war. He did it all. He looked cool doing it. John Olerud gets my vote.
That's a hard helmet to overcome if you're another Met looking for the first base vote here. This, like I said, is a stacked group, and I'm just going to tell you that John Milner deserves special consideration here because John Milner is the reason I thought of this. When I was 12 years old, I'm looking at Baseball Digest, and I decided, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to make an all-star team of players who have never been to all-star teams, of all National League players and all American League players. And my first baseman in 1975, although he wasn't having a very good season, was John Milner. And I assumed that, you know what, someday John Milner is going to make an all-star team. He didn't. It feels good to acknowledge him here. Ike Davis really was a big deal when he came up that first half. Those catches all came like a few weeks into his tenure. I bought a We Like Ike t-shirt as soon as it was available. And Don Glendenning should have carried more of an aura with the voters. Again, you have to remember, this position is always stacked. For, again, going back to 1970, it's the fans voting. So I can understand in the era of Lee May and Willie McCovey and whoever else, you're not necessarily going to be able to get Don Glendenning on there. But I really wish Don Glendenning had gotten more of a shake in his day. But for me, it comes down to the two former Blue Jays, John Olerud and Carlos Delgado. And it kills me that John Olerud never made an all-star team because he was such an important part of getting this franchise on its feet again in the late 90s. And it kills me that Carlos Delgado didn't make the all-star team in 2006 because the Mets were too good. The Mets sent six all-stars that year. And you know what happens? Well, we can't have everybody from the Mets. And since you gave Olerud your slot, I'm not doing this to be contrary, I'm going to give Carlos Delgado my slot. You could do it for 2008, except he wasn't off to a great start. I tried to stay in the first half as I thought about this. Delgado, go back and look at his April. It was amazing. And when you look at that Sports Illustrated cover from right around the All-Star break that year, you see five Mets on the cover. Four of them made the All-Star team. One of them was Delgado, who didn't. I'm putting Carlos Delgado on the All-Star team. So that's our first base picks. John Olerud for Jeff, Carlos Delgado for me, but I could very easily go with Olerud. Okay, but we have to make choices here. We're going on to second base, represented at All-Star Games Past by Ron Hunt in 1964 at Shea Stadium and Busch Stadium in 1966. The great Edgardo Alfonso in 2000, Daniel Murphy in 2014, and Jeff McNeil in 2019 and 2022. Remember Jeff McNeil? Anyway, we can have fifths on second, right? We choose among Wally Backman, 1986. Wally's hitting 354 in early July, as much of a top-of-the-order spark plug as anybody is for the team that's running away with its division. Doug Flynn, 1980. It's the gold glove season of the Cincinnati cast-off. Doug looking every ground ball into his glove, as Bob Murphy put it. Greg Jeffries, 1990. Has Greg finally come into his own? In May and June, right after he gets David Cone's attention to throw home in Atlanta, you remember the play, he hits 335, and he's on his way to leading the league in doubles with 40. Jeff Kent, 1994, the guy we traded David Cone for, is making it look like a fantastic deal, bursting from the gate with 10 homers and 39 RBIs in roughly his first quarter of the season. And Felix Mian, 1975. Not only has Felix Mian played every game of the first half, he will play every game of the second half too. The only Met to do that. And when the year is done, he will break his own record for most hits by a Met in a season. These are a lot of good Met second basemen who didn't go to the All-Star game as Mets, and it doesn't even include Ken Boswell in 1970, the year he set a record for consecutive errorless games by a second baseman. Tim Tuffle in 1987, when the Tuffle Shuffle elevated his batting average to a career-high 308. Jose Valentin in 2006, the projected bench player who stepped up to everyday status and socked 18 long balls. And Neil Walker in 2016, who didn't make us forget Daniel Murphy, but sure hit his share of homers with 23. Who is your National League retroactive All-Star second baseman, Jeff?
In a year where we're talking about the future now and looking at young players and hoping that they live up to their potential, wondering if they will, I think back to Greg Jeffries. He never did. We had such high hopes for him. There were long articles about him. He would take swings in a swimming pool to build his strength. But in 1990, we started to see that potential. Maybe that was his apex. Overall, he had 15 home runs, 96 runs scored, 68 RBI, 11 stolen bases. Never a great defender. But he started to give us a taste of what we had dreamed of. We never got there, but 1990, we saw some of it. That's why he gets my vote at second base.
Jeffries has his best Met season in 1990. Goes on, actually makes a couple of All-Star teams for the Cardinals, but of course, we don't care. We're talking about the Mets. Jeffries was a big part of a team that was coming on strong. Jeff Kent was a big part of a team that was shaking off an absolutely miserable year of 1993 and making us think, hey, this season's not going to be so bad. Kind of cooled off. I remember being surprised he wasn't picked that year. Doug Flynn actually was reported to be making the All-Star team in 1981 after the strike, when they were going to have expanded rosters and they were kind of scuffling to put a game together in Cleveland. Then it turned out he didn't make it. And it was kind of in deference to how good a defender he was and how good he was in 1980. Sadly, defense first players usually don't make it. Wally Backman was having his best year in the Mets' best year, and I don't think it's a coincidence. Platoon player, again, I think that kind of holds you back, even though he was playing more often than Tuffle in 1986. The guy I'm going to put on there, it's a guy, it really bothers me, surprises me, however you want to put it, never made it as a Met to an All-Star team. Felix Mian, just the glue, along with Bud Harrelson, but a real difference maker to that infield, especially 1973, made them a double play combination to be reckoned with. I picked 75 because he did play every day. No Met has played every single game of a season, and he did, and it would go on for another 20 years, held the single season hits record. Lance Johnson would break that. Mian was an All-Star, I think, three times with the Braves. I guess he just, you know, again, this is the era of Joe Morgan kind of being an automatic pick and some other players coming and going from that perch. So a little overlooked in Met history. It won't be overlooked by me. Felix Mian is my second baseman. So we have a first baseman, we have a second baseman. Hey, let's go to the most infamous position on the Mets historical diamond, the place where for decades it was believed nobody would ever hold down a corner that was too hot. Yes, third base. Somehow, despite its reputation, the Mets have sent three third basemen to the All-Star game. Recent Hall of Fame inductee Howard Johnson, who went in 1989 and 1991. The captain, David Wright, at All-Star every year from 2006 through 2010 and again in 2012 and 2013, the latter of those at Citi Field. And in between them, although he eludes fond memories at any position, Bobby Bonilla in 1995, his second time as a Met 2 years after he went the first time as more or less an outfielder. But there could have been another Mets third baseman in an All-Star game. We've got the candidates right here. Hubie Brooks, 1984, the first Met widely considered as the third baseman to stop the revolving door of the hot corner. Hubie's bat was particularly heated in the first half of the Mets' renaissance year with a 24-game hitting streak. Wayne Garrett, 1973, the redhead fended off one interloper after another and took over third base for good by the All-Star break, and his 16 homers would become a primary reason we had to believe. Ray Knight, 1986. Few third basemen seemed like excess inventory more than Ray entering 1986. But by mid-year, we realized he was an essential piece of a first-place juggernaut. He'd be comeback player of the year for the regular season and MVP in the World Series. Lenny Randle, 1977. All Lenny wanted was a puncher's chance after coming over from Texas after the Rangers released him for mixing it up with his manager. And at third base, Randle struck a blow for second opportunities, leading the team in steals and batting. And Robin Ventura, 1999. Every time you turned around in the first months of 1999, Robin was delivering big hits, like the May doubleheader when he launched a pair of grand slams, building a foundation for his own impressive stats, 120 RBIs, and a team whose mojo he'd get rising come October. Quick hat tips are in order, too, for former NL MVP Ken Boyer, who led the 1966 Mets in runs batted in and out of the cellar for the first time. Ed Charles, top slugger for the 1968 Mets, to say nothing of poet laureate of the 1969 Mets. Charlie Smith, who in 1964 became the second Met to hit 20 homers in a season, and even Richie Hebner, reviled 1979 Met, who nonetheless reached the midpoint of his one season at Shea close to a 100 RBI pace. Not bad for a position written off as the province of short-timers and never-wars, but which one among them is a New York Mets all-star third baseman?
I'm not going to charge the mound if you don't pick Robin Ventura. I'm not going to stop you at second base if you don't pick Robin Ventura, but I hope you will. He gets my vote. What a season he had in 1999, culminated by the Grand Slam single in the NLCS. He had 32 home runs, as you said, 120 RBI, but he did it offensively and defensively. When I was doing research for this selection, I was surprised at how I had forgotten what a great season he had and what a great player he has. Maybe he should have become a Mets manager. He never did, but he does get my vote, and he should have been an All-Star in 1999.
Robin Ventura had an All-Star season in 1999 in all but name, but so did Ray Knight in 1986, a year where, again, just so many Mets were having great years, you couldn't have everybody there. Lenny Randle got to the Mets in late April, but put up the all-star numbers on the team and was just a delight to have around, which was interesting to experience considering he punched his manager, Frank Lucchesi, in Texas. Hubie Brooks really is an important historical figure in that he really was the third baseman about whom it was written. That said, we can stop writing. Oh my God, the Mets can never find a third baseman type stories. And of course, Hubie Brooks' destiny was to move to shortstop and then to Montreal. And Wayne Garrett, just again, time has, I think, faded the memory of how important he was to that 73 club, to that 69 club, and just holding down a position when every year they're trading for guys. But I'm coming back to what you said, Robin Ventura, to me, MVP of the 1999 Mets, first playoff team in 11 years. To me, a very good case for MVP of the National League, which went to Larry Chipper Jones, unfortunately, because that'll happen. But again, this was a period where there were a lot of players putting up good numbers, and Ventura got a little lost in the shuffle at All-Star time. But I tell you, you watched him every day, went to a lot of games that year. Most amazing third baseman I ever saw play for the Mets. And they weren't kidding about the best infield ever. But you know what? We're not done with the infield. Need strength up the middle, my friend. The Mets have had two of the great shortstops of their time recognized with All-Star berths. Buddy Harrelson in 1970 and 1971, and Jose Reyes in 2006, 2007, 2010, and 2011. But we have a few more shortstops who could have covered some ground in the Midsummer Classic. Astrubal Cabrera, 2016. Heard of a glue guy? Astrubal kept the Mets infield and lineup together as the club scuffled toward a return trip to the playoffs. By year's end, he'd set the record for most home runs by a Mets shortstop. Kevin Elster, 1989. Smooth as silk in the field and featuring surprise pop at the plate. Kevin brought a National League consecutive games errorless streak into the season from 1988 and kept it going into 1989. Ray Ordonez, 1999. Two gold gloves were in Ray's trophy case when 1999 began, and he'd be adding to his collection as the anchor of the best infield ever, no question mark needed, as he was flirting with a 300 batting average as the All-Star break approached. Rafael Santana, 1987. The nation saw what Rafi could do when they watched him man the infield's most essential position in the previous year's postseason, and Santana was keeping it up in 87, elevating his power production as well. And Frank Tavares, 1979. The Pirates preferred Tim Foley, but the Mets were happy to take Tavares in trade, as Frankie brought the Mets speed they never had before, culminating in a then-club record 42 stolen bases. Kudos, if not a spot on our ballot, to the original Mets slugging shortstop, Eddie Brasseau from 1966, Amed Rosario, who was rounding into form as an everyday two-way player in 2019, and the consistent if overlooked Jose Vizcaino, who put up solid numbers for the 1995 Mets. Yet we can elect only one retroactive Mets All-Star shortstop. Who is it going to be?
I'm going to cheat here because it's supposed to be about a half season or a full season. I'm going to give it to Astrubal Cabrera for one moment. I had trouble with this category, and I went through all of the candidates, but the one moment that stood out for me was the reason why I picked Astrubal Cabrera, and that's that walk-off home run against Philadelphia with that epic bat flip in September, 11th inning, Mets win 9-8. Astrubal Cabrera with that bat flip. Find it on YouTube and watch it another dozen times. I know you have watched it already. It's fantastic. Astrubal Cabrera, by the way, that year, I was surprised at this. He had 23 home runs. That was his first year as a Met. He did it all. What a great player. I love Astrubal Cabrera. I love that bat flip, and I love giving him my vote.
As I recall, you weren't too enthused about the Mets signing Astrubal Cabrera coming into that year. He converted you.
He certainly did.
Well, you know, I mean, he did everything for that team, including, if you remember, he had the shtick with taking the helmet off the guy who came in with a home run and polishing it for them. And just a great team player, great glue guy. And I will add the MVM, most valuable Met, according to Faith and Fear in Flushing for 2016. And yet I'm not necessarily sold on Cabrera because we have, listen, there were five players on the ballot here. We have the greatest shortstop the Mets ever had from a defensive standpoint on this ballot. And that's Ray Ordonez. And what is an All-Star game, if not an exhibition of the best players in the game? And if you can't at least once have the best defensive shortstop you've ever seen, and I include Ozzie Smith and Omar Vizquel and anybody else you want to name, if you can't have the best defensive shortstop you've ever seen exhibit his skills for at least a couple of innings in the field, what's the point of the All-Star game? And he really was a more than adequate hitter in 1999. which is probably the equivalent of saying Asdrubal Cabrera hit 23 home runs. Listen, Ordóñez was never a very good hitter. He got hot at mid-year. The Mets were actually pushing him, advertising, taking out actual ads, if I'm not mistaken, in newspapers, telling you vote for Ray Ordóñez. I think it was the first year that there was some component of online voting, and they really pushed this, and he fell short anyway. Again, you know, Barry Larkin is in his prime at that point. Again, we invoke the best infield ever cover from Sports Illustrated. We've already got Alfonso on an actual All-Star team. You've got Olerud as your first baseman, and we both decided on Ventura. We're making it a clean sweep for the 1999 Mets in some universe. All four of them are on an All-Star team. My man's Ray Ordóñez, always has been defensively, and if he could lay down a few more bunts, it would have been great. So we have our infield, but we're not done because we're going behind the plate. One position where the Mets have never had to feel left out at All-Star time is catcher. We've sent six. Jerry Grody in 1968 and 1974. Gary Carter from 1985 to 1988. Todd Hundley in 1996 and 1997. Mike Piazza every year from 1998 to 2002. And again in 2004 and 2005. And Paul Laduca in 2006. We've had our fair share, and we don't want to be greedy. But let's see if maybe there's one more catcher out there who can crouch in glory for us. John Buck, 2013. Every time in the past decade that a Met drives in a bushel of runs in April, the name John Buck is usually referenced, as in, not since John Buck in 2013. He got off to a hell of a start, and he helped a young pitcher named Matt Harvey do the same. Travis d'Arnaud, 2017. One of the top catching prospects in the game entered 2017, seeming to have come into his own, still carrying some of the aura of his 2015 postseason production. Travis was responsible for the last true marathon win in Mets history, belting the 16th inning homer that beat the Marlins that April. Jesse Gonder, 1964. Jesse was the first everyday Met catcher to post league average production. And if you don't think that's a feat, you haven't spent much time staring at early Met statistics. Wilson Ramos, 2019. The Mets needed a proven commodity behind the plate, and in 2019, they got it with Wilson, who batted over 300 in the 41-game span that preceded the All-Star break. In the second half, he'd hit in 26 games in a row, second-best streak in Met club history. And Mackie Sasser, 1990. The 1990 Mets were on fire, and Mackie the Hacker helped light the match. In 33 games, during which the Mets climbed from nowhere to the thick of it, Sasser slashed 385, 420, 510, and nobody was complaining about his defense. All right, we're going to be greedy. How about another Met All-Star catcher for old time's sake?
Part of the purpose of this is to right some wrongs, and Mackie Sasser is only remembered for his tick, for not being able to throw the ball back. It's become a movie trope or a literary trope. Mm-hmm. The overrated book, The Art of Fielding, featured that. The fielder had trouble throwing the ball back. That's all that Mackie Sasser is remembered for. He was a better ball player than just for his failures. He was a good ball player, and he had a good season. He gets my vote.
I already referenced 1990, I think, a couple of times. That was a season a little like 2023, where they were just muddling along, and this part is different. They suddenly got hot. Everybody got hot. And Sasser takes over at a position where there was a void. Barry Lyons had kind of cycled out, and Orlando Mercado had gotten some starts, and you'd see some guys come and go in the course of the year. And Sasser took over, and we always knew he could hit, and now he was the everyday catcher for guys like Viola and Gooden and Cohn, and it's not insignificant. All that said, I'm going with Travis d'Arnaud. Forget that he's on the Atlanta Braves now. The Travis d'Arnaud I am going for was on his way, in my mind, to becoming one of those guys who was going to make the All-Star team on a fairly regular basis. And by 2017, the next step was ready to be taken. By later in 2017, Kevin Plawecki was getting most of the starts. But when the year began, you know, Darnold was an important part of a team that was expected to contend, a guy who had been a huge part of the 2015 team once he got healthy in the second half. And I guess for that feeling of, gee, if only, with all respect to what you said, because Sasser deserves to be remembered for more than not being able to throw back to the mound. My heart, I have to go Travis Darnold, 2017. And you'll notice I didn't even throw on any honorable mentions here because we've got six catchers. We are greedy, but, you know, we're not going to leave catcher out of this equation. But now we move on to a cornucopia of talent, the outfield, where in all-star selection protocol, that's how it's known, the outfield, rather than left, center, and right. Picked as Met outfielders over the year have been Richie Ashburn, Duke Snider, Cleon Jones, the greatest player of all time, Willie Mays twice as a Met, Dave Kingman, Lee Mazzilli, Joel Youngblood, Darryl Strawberry seven times, the aforementioned Bobby Bonilla once. Isn't it something to remember Bobby Bonilla Day used to mean the day they told us he was an all-star? Lance Johnson, Carlos Beltran five times, including 2007, fresh off his unforgettable run-up Tal's Hill in Houston. Michael Conforto, Yoenis Cespedes, and Starling Marte. That's a ton of talent. Let's add a few more ounces to that talent pool. And since this is our ballot, we'll do it by outfield position, starting with left. George Foster, 1984. Forget George's first year when he told planes to avoid flying low over Shea, only to have air traffic controllers at LaGuardia merrily ignore him. In 1984, George was at the heart of the surge to Met contention. His final dozen games before the break saw him hit close to 300 as the Mets grabbed hold of first place. He finished the year with 86 RBIs, reminding us there was still thunder in that black bat. Cliff Floyd, 2005. Healthy for a full year for once, Cliff lifted the Mets beyond respectability with a 903 OPS in the first half and 22 homers from April into July, highlighted by the game-winning shot he blasted off the Angels in the 11th inning in June at Shea. Bernard Gilkey, 1996. Why was an alien craft hovering over Shea Stadium in 1997's Men in Black? Because they wanted a better look at Bernard Gilkey after the year the former Cardinal had in 1996, highlighted by 62 first-half RBIs en route to a franchise record-tying 117. Kevin McReynolds, 1988. Quiet consistency was the hallmark of the man from Arkansas, never more so than in 88, when K-Mac challenged for the NL MVP, propelled by a superb offensive and defensive first half. Stole 21 bases that year, never got caught, and they didn't even have to enlarge the bags. Frank Thomas, 1962, 34 home runs and 94 RBIs for the team that lost 120 games, not to mention flirting with a 300 average in the first half. Frank's records would stick around as Met hallmarks for years, a true original. And how can we leave left without a nod to two men who shared a last name and their share of heroics? Let's hear a little something for Steve Henderson, who hit the Steve Henderson home run and did plenty more in 1980, and Hall of Famer Ricky Henderson, who on the offensively gifted 1999 Mets led all regulars in batting, though who would ever call the otherworldly Ricky regular? Somebody in this group ought to be referred to as a one-time Met All-Star, but who?
I look to the sky at that alien spaceship and pick Bernard Gilkey. Greg, I wonder if we've forgotten how good Bernard Gilkey was. In 1996, as you said, he had 30 home runs, 108 RBI, 17 steals. His defensive war was 16.4. He did it on offense, and he did it on defense. And yet, I think we've forgotten about him in Mets history. I didn't forget about him today, and he gets my vote.
Gilkey was a Met for three seasons, but I think he's the epitome of a one-year wonder in a way, because that one year was so off the charts compared to what he would do later as a Met, and he would have some big hits later on. and what he did as a Cardinal and what he would do after he left the Mets. I'll tell you what he got out of 1996. He got a nice contract. The Mets thought they were set at left field, never dreaming that 1996 would be the stuff of UFOs, never to be identified again. This is a good group. Not having been around in 62 except in utero, I'm not quite sure why Frank Thomas wasn't actually picked. I know Richie Ashburn got the nod and ended up hitting over 300, but Thomas was having a real power year. And, you know, Kevin McReynolds, he was the quiet man, and he took some grief for that, but he could really do it all. And all-star recognition eluded him, and he was probably just happy to go home for 3 days. I got to go with Cliff Floyd, though. Cliff Floyd was having a massive year in 2005. And that was a team where you had Wright and Reyes coming up and showing their stuff. And you had Beltran, who got elected that year, I think, off the strength of his fantastic postseason with Houston in 2004. And the headlines he made for what at the time was an amazing contract. But it was Floyd, more than anybody, who's carrying that offense and putting that team on the map. Floyd and Pedro Martinez were the two main reasons we could think about the Mets as wild card contenders. And again, just one of these guys you loved listening to, you loved watching, you loved everything about him, and you loved that he was healthy. So all due respect to Gilkey and the year he would wind up having, and it's a tough call. I got to go with Cliff Floyd. Congratulations to both of you guys for making our retroactive all-star team. And we're going to move over to center, where we have some authentic Met legends to consider. Let's get to them. Tommy Agee, 1970. Tommy saved every bit of the Mets bacon in the third game of the 1969 World Series and just kept cooking as one of the bright spots of their title defense a year later with power, speed, and the first gold glove in Mets history. Agee would be inducted into the Mets Hall of Fame posthumously in 2002. Lenny Dykstra, 1986. Marry me, Lenny, went the sign, the lady in the bridal gown paraded in the stands, home and away. And in our younger, innocent days, we thought we'd want to be betrothed to Dykstra's spit and vinegar forever. Lenny picked up for the injured Mookie Wilson early on and carried a batting average just shy of 350 into the break. Juan Lagares, 2014, owner of the glove where extra base hits went to die and proprietor of the best Met war of 2014, which seems worth noting in that it was built mostly on league-leading defense. Juan was an okay hitter, but it was his fielding that made him the people's choice, as in the torrent of tweets that demanded Terry Collins free Juan Lagares. Del Unser, 1975. For a while, the Tug McGraw trade was the Del Unser trade, as the former Philly came to New York and filled a gap that had widened since the departure of Tommy Agee, hitting an eyelash from 300 when the All-Star break arrived. And Mookie Wilson, 1982. Moo would seem to cover Mr. Wilson's credentials as the Met who fans loved from 1980 to 1989. But let the record show that in his first true full year, one without a strike interrupting play, Mookie set the franchise mark for stolen bases with 58, fourth best in the league, and finished second in the NL with triples with 9, emitting joy no matter what base he was sliding into. In 1996, Mookie became the first of the 1986 Mets inducted into the Mets Hall of Fame. No rundown of would-be Met All-Star center fielders would be complete without a thumbs-up to the exploits of Mike Cameron in 2004. He would hit 30 home runs by year's end. Rookie of the Year contender Jay Payton in 2000, and injury-rehabilitating Carlos Beltran's understudy Angel Pagan, who shone in the spotlight in 2010. Let's get centered on our center field pick, shall we?
When Juan Lagares didn't catch a fly ball, I was surprised. What did they say? The water covers two-thirds of the Earth's surface, and Juan Lagares covers the other third. What a great fielder. Let's recognize that. Juan Lagares gets my votes.
Center field, defensive position, I can totally see it. And he wasn't a bad hitter by any means, especially in 2014 when he's going on to win the Gold Glove. In a lot of ways, for me, this is a legacy position because we have two of our five candidates are in the Hall of Fame of this franchise, yet they were never All-Stars, which I think tells you how important they were to the franchise. I mean, Mookie Wilson, he was just at the ballpark this week making a presentation to the veteran of the game. And it's, you know, he's never left us, thank goodness, except for, I guess, a couple of years in Toronto. Huge part of the franchise. The funny thing about Mookie is we know about his exploits in a certain game of a certain World Series. He never really had that one great year. You know, you can pick out, as I did, some great speed-based numbers, and he's just a consistent good player. And then there's a spot for that in a team's legacy, let's say. Tommy Agee, it saddens me that Tommy Agee did not live to see his induction into the Met Hall of Fame. I don't know what they were waiting for. Coming out of 69, this is one of those things where you would think it would carry over with voters or with whoever was making out the reserves for the 1970 All-Star team. Two very good, if not, again, this is the era of Aaron and Mays and Clemente and Rose and so many great National League outfielders. I guess AG was just at that next level in those minds. But you know what? As much as it pains me to ignore Tommy AG in this, I have to be true to my 12-year-old self. And I have been carrying around a 48-year grudge against Walter Alston, the late manager of the Los Angeles Dodgers and the National League champions in 1974, All-Star manager in 1975. I'm looking forward to the selections of the 1975 All-Star team, knowing that we're going to see Tom Seaver and figuring maybe we're going to see John Matlack. And absolutely sure we're going to see Del Unser, who has come here and had a terrific first half, taking over in center field, a position that had gone kind of to seed, like I said, since AG. And he's hitting 300 most of the first half, and he's making great plays. And then the All-Star selections come out, and Del Unser is nowhere to be found. And I have, in all of my never getting over it, this may be the longest never getting over it in my history as a fan. And that'll include the 1973 World Series, if you know just how much it means to me for Del Unser to have made the 1975 All-Star team. Love Tommy Agee, love Mookie Wilson, love Juan Lagares, and once upon a time, I loved Lenny Dykstra. But baby, I got to vote for Del Unser if I have the chance. That is my center fielder, but we got to go around and right now. Round and right, as Lindsey Nelson liked to finish out his presentation of the Met defense. We have a few names that might very well seem the right choice for an All-Star berth. Jay Bruce, 2017. The power was there. 23 home runs and 59 RBIs after Jay's first 81 games played, which adds up to an extraordinary pace over a full season. Joe Christopher, 1964, a very decent first half, was setting the stage for an outstanding second half, with Joe producing a 300 average when that was a magic number. Curtis Granderson, 2015. There were nights in the first half when Curtis Granderson represented the entirety of the Met offense. There was never a night when Curtis Granderson didn't represent the eventual National League champions with impeccable class. Rusty Staub, 1975. Le Grand Orange might have been on his way to making the All-Star team as a Met in 1972 before a pitch broke his hand. Healthy 3 years later, he'd become the first Met to drive in 100 runs in a season. In 1986, the year after he retired, Rusty joined Buddy Harrelson as the first players inducted into the Mets Hall of Fame. And Ron Swoboda, 1968. Sports Illustrated wouldn't put just anybody on the cover in its golden age, so Ron Swoboda must have been off to a heck of a start to make the front of America's preeminent sports magazine that May. By the end of 1969, Ron and his teammates would make all the periodicals. We can't finish going around and right without acknowledging super veteran Marlon Byrd from 2013, sudden speedster Roger Cedeno from 1999, and one of those guys you didn't realize how much you missed until he was traded, Xavier Nady from 2006. It is only right that some Met right fielder not already tabbed get the pick from us.
There was a Wordle word this week that gave me the answer because I wasn't sure. I wanted to pick Rusty Staub, but the Wordle word this week was grand, and that told me that Curtis Granderson was the right choice. What a season he had. What a great ambassador for the game. He did it offensively. He did it defensively, but he had power, consistent power. The Mets don't get to the World Series without him. I think he was a terrific ball player. I wish he was around Citi Field more. Curtis Granderson gets my vote.
And he was an on-base machine that year. The batting average was always low, but he got his share of walks. And at a time where people really began to pay attention to that, and Granderson has, I believe, the last home run in Mets World Series history. Hopefully not the last ever, but it stands there right now. I want to tip a cap here to Jay Bruce again, because like Unser, although I didn't take it as seriously in 2017 because I wasn't 12 years old anymore, I thought Jay Bruce got screwed out of an all-star pick in 2017, and I'm still carrying that around a little bit. But, you know, Jay Bruce, we don't really think of him as, wow, what a great Met, but kind of was for a little while. You know, I just also want to just reiterate, Joe Christopher hit 300 for the 1964 Mets. Hardly anybody hit 300 for the Mets in those days. He was had a really good year. If we had been around then and experiencing the Mets, we would probably still be talking about Joe Christopher. And we both love Ron Swoboda a lot. But geez, Rusty Staubs, another one in the Met Hall of Fame and never made an all-star team. Made it as an expo. Again, we don't care. But never made it as a Met. You know, could have made it as a pinch hitter years later. But this was his best all-around healthy season. And it's impossible to me to think of Rusty Staub as not an all-star as a Met. So even though I'm not doing much for the chronological diversity here, because I'm picking a 75 Met next to a 75 Met in Del Unser, I don't care. Rusty Staub is my right fielder. So there you have. We've gone around the diamond. We have our positions that we see at the All-Star game. But before we finish with position players, we're going to treat ourselves to a category called One Extra Guy. Players who are having pretty big years while not necessarily playing as regulars. Somewhere between utility men and starters, there's inevitably that one extra guy. Our guys are Benny Agbayani, 1999. Came up with little fanfare in May and started homering every time you looked. Benny, indeed, is what we called Hawaiian Punch. Endy Chavez, 2006. Long before October, Endy was making himself indispensable from left to right in the Met outfield, with plenty of big hits and some big catches, if not yet his biggest. Carl Everett, 1997. The team that came out of nowhere got quite a bit of its pop from an outfielder who filled in here, there, and everywhere, walking off the Pirates in June before mashing his signature blow, a game-tying ninth-inning grand slam versus Montreal in September. Wilmer Flores, 2016, played everywhere in the infield, but his true position was in our heart. Yet lest you think Wilmer is only about tears of joy, let's remember that Sunday afternoon in early July when Wilmer matched Edgardo Alfonso in the Met record books by going 6-for-6. At Art Chamsky, 1970. Some right field, some first base, some kind of presence for Gil Hodges in this, his third year since coming over from Cincinnati. Some kind of presence in keeping the 1969 Mets legacy thriving too. There isn't a specific category in the All-Star game for guys in this kind of role, but we believe there ought to be. Who, though, ought to be our one extra guy?
Carl Everett said, "You can't say that there were dinosaurs when you never saw them." Well, I saw Carl Everett. I saw all of these players, and I'm picking Wilmer Flores in our hearts on the field. What a great season he had that year. Wilmer Flores gets my vote.
It's a good vote. And he, you know why he had to play so many positions that he didn't play very well? Because that bat could play anywhere. Love Wilmer Flores. Like all these guys, Carl Everett's kind of a hard guy to like, but boy, he was really good that year. And Benny was just one of those guys. I remember writing Benny Agbayani's name onto All-Star ballots. I think it's the last time I did that. Actual taking my pen out of my pocket and writing his name. But, you know, since we're sort of taking the long view here and the historical view here, I'm voting for Art Chamsky, because Art Chamsky was a darn good hitter in 69 and 70. 70 happens to be the year I started paying attention on a full-time basis. And I remember thinking, wow, Art Chamsky's really good. He hit, I think, 293 that year, hit 300 in 69. But more than that, more than what he gave Gil Hodges, you know, Art Chamsky is always out there speaking for the 1969 Mets more than anybody, not taking credit for them, but being, remember, Michael Bamberger in Sports Illustrated on the 40th anniversary of the 69 Mets ran a wonderful cover story talking specifically about the players who were still hanging around in New York after all these years, Art Shamsky being one of them. And he referred to Art Shamsky as kind of the class secretary of the 1969 Mets. And I think that was a beautiful phrase, and it really fits. And I've had the privilege of speaking to Art Shamsky a few times, and I've certainly listened to him speak to others. And he always says some variation on the following. You know, I played in the major leagues for 9 years, but nobody ever asks me about the other eight. Well, meaning 1969 is all anybody wants to talk about. Well, you know what? And I said this to him when he said that. I said, well, you know what? I remember you from 1970, and you were really good. And I would like more people to go up to Art Shamsky and say, hey, Art, can you tell us about that time you made the All-Star team for the, as a 1970 Met? So in my mind, it has already happened. So we congratulate Wilmer Flores, and we congratulate Art Shamsky.
Let me tell you my Art Shamsky story. Not when he spoke at Temple Israel when I was very young, but I was the MC of the first Queens Baseball Convention. And Greg, every year, bestows the Unforgettable Fire Award. And I was waiting for Greg to speak. And I was, again, the MC. And I sat there with Gil Hodges Jr., because Gil Hodges was getting the award, and Art Shamsky, who was going to introduce Gil Hodges Jr. And I'm sitting with them, and I just was awestruck sitting with Gil Hodges' son and Art Shamsky. And Art Shamsky turns to me, takes off his ring, and says, you want to put it on? The 69 World Series ring. I've never forgotten that. What a great act of kindness. What a great moment. Great player. And that was a great pick, Greg.
Art Shamsky can read a room. Absolutely. And you know what? He showed up, I think it was, let's see, that was 2014, 3 years later. He showed up unannounced at the QBC. We were giving the award to Tom Seaver. Tom Seaver was not flying in from Napa Valley to Astoria to get the award. But Art Shamsky caught wind that there was an award being given to Tom Seaver and wanted to accept on his behalf. And except on behalf of the 69 Mets, wasn't looking to get paid. I think he may have brought some copies of his book and was happy to sell them, as anybody who's written a book will take the opportunity, but that's fine. And give autographs and whatever else. And again, he's not really the most outgoing guy on the surface. I mean, I don't know him, but like I said, I've actually spoken to him a few times. So he's not somebody who's like ever seems to be seeking attention, but he has taken it upon himself to be that guy, to be the living embodiment of the 69 Mets. And there are a few guys who make those sorts of appearances, but they're not always available. And Art has made that a big part of his life, and we're all better off for it. So yeah, that's my all-star one extra guy. And now we have our position players, but hey, what's an all-star game and what is Mets baseball without pitching, right? Major League Baseball doesn't ask the fans to pick the starting pitchers. But National League Town figures, why not? Granted, this is an area where Mets excellence has rarely been overlooked. Tom Seaver was selected 10 times, and though Tom is the mountaintop, it's not a far drop to other Mets starters who got the call and sometimes the ball. Jerry Kuzman twice, John Matlack three times, Pat Zachary, Dwight Gooden four times, Ron Darling, Sid Fernandez, David Cohn twice, Frank Viola twice, Brett Saberhagen, Bobby Jones, Rick Reed twice, Al Leiter, Tom Glavine twice, Pedro Martinez twice, Johan Santana, R.A. Dickey, Matt Harvey, Jacob deGrom four times, Noah Syndergaard, Bartolo Colon, and Taijuan Walker. What a staff! But what about Mark Bomback, 1980? The magic is back, Mets, with a delightful surprise of the first half of that year. An unheralded offseason pickup, Boom Boom, as he was called, was leading Mets starters in victories. Gary Gentry, 1971. We can all use a reminder of what a mainstay Gary was to the Mets, who kept competing at a high level after 1969. In 71, the young gun was smoking, with 7 wins and an ERA under 3 before July. Terry Leach, 1987. How was every Terry Leach start in 1987 not sponsored by Lifesavers? But the rotation having developed a hole in its center, the Submariner emerged from the shadows and confounded hitters, By July 7th, he had his record at 8-0 and his earned run average down toward 2. Bobby Ojeda, 1986, an already loaded pitching staff packed on yet another capable left arm in the preceding offseason, practically guaranteeing the 1986 Mets would have an unfair, if perfectly legal, advantage over every lineup in the league. Imagine letting them add Bobby Ojeda, who at the All-Star break was 10-2 with a 2.24 ERA, with grittiness and greatness to come. And Craig Swan, 1978, the last superb homegrown starting pitcher the Mets manufactured as if from a factory in the 1960s and 1970s. Swanee blossomed as a bona fide ace on his way to leading the National League in earned run average. Listen, Seaver, Gooden, DeGrom, we haven't gone wanting for all-star starting pitchers, but we can always slip one more onto the foul line for introductions, can't we? Who carries our additional arm?
Bobby O gets my vote. What a season he had in 1986. The Mets don't win the World Series without him. They acquired him from the Red Sox. He pitched against the Red Sox in the World Series. He pitched great. He wasn't the brightest star on the 1986 team, but he was integral to that team. The Mets don't win the World Series without him. He should have been on the All-Star team.
He absolutely should have been on the All-Star team. And with as much love as I could possibly express for Craig Swan, who really was, you know, when you're 15 years old in the late 70s and the Mets are going nowhere, you take so much pride in a guy who is going to lead the league in earned run average and a guy whose one lost record doesn't reflect just what a tough pitcher he was. Geez, Bobby Ojeda, to me, is the 1986 Mets in a lot of ways. The best pitcher on the staff that had Gooden and Darling and Fernandez and Aguilera. Maybe it's not a coincidence that he was the veteran. I feel myself channeling Keith Hernandez at the altar of the veteran, but he really brought something to that staff. It was already a talented staff, but now it was a formidable staff in ways you couldn't calculate with numbers, but hey, you had the numbers. He winds up with 18 wins. And I remember distinctly reading an article in which Whitey Herzog, maybe he's blowing a little smoke at that point because the division is out of reach. And again, he's the all-star manager that year. And he says, boy, I could take 9 or 10 guys from the Mets if I had the space. And he ticks off a lot of names. And one of them was Bobby Ojeda. And at the time, I'm thinking, well, of course you're going to take Bobby Ojeda. Look at the first half he's having. And somehow he gets left off. He never has quite that kind of year again. When you have a chance for fun, folks, and I'm sure this is how you want to have fun, go to Bobby Ojeda's 1988 statistics. Go look at his interior numbers or whatever you want to call them. His one loss record isn't very good. He's got 5 shutouts, I think. Just like one of your more snake bit lefties in that year. Again, 86 stands out. 87, we know he gets injured. And then after 88, when we remember 88 for the finger and the hedge clipping accident, and who knows what effect that had on the team in the playoffs. And after that, he's kind of scuffling, and it's kind of not sad. He wasn't a terrible pitcher by any means. He had some good starts in 89 and 90, absolutely. 88, he was as good as he ever was, and it just didn't show up. And it kind of, again, got lost among the glamorous set that was the Mets rotation. But here we are in agreement. Probably the best unrewarded in terms of an all-star selection year any starting pitcher ever had, Bobby Ojeda, for the Mets. Maybe for everybody, I don't know. Bobby Ojeda, 1986. Okay, we've got our starter. Now, before we get to the back end of the all-star game, let's stop off in middle relief, talking about an area where there's no glamour. It's an area that rarely gets any Midsummer Classic love. No Met who wasn't what we think of as a closer or in days of yore a fireman has ever been selected as an all-star as a reliever. So let's do something about that right now. Let's pick ourselves a setup man. They're practically everyday players anyway. Okay. Larry Bernarth, 1964. In consecutive outings, the St. John's product, as Bob Murphy would want you to know, pitched 17 innings. That's 2 consecutive outings in relief. 7 innings and 1 run in the legendary 23-inning nightcap of May 31st. And then a never-going-to-be-broken 10 innings of relief with just 1 run allowed on June 9th. That's an all-star caliber month. Dennis Cook, 1998. The Mets looked for a dependable lefty specialist for about 15 years. It took a Marlins fire sale to gift them one. Dennis not only took care of batters, he picked off a pair of Milwaukee base runners during a single at bat the night the Mets traded for Mike Piazza. Talk about good omens. Pedro Feliciano, 2010. Perpetual Pedro was in the midst of a 92-appearance season, which followed years when he emerged from the pen 64, 78, 86, and 88 times. One more call from any given National League All-Star team's manager would have been richly deserved. Doug Sisk, 1984. Before he became synonymous with that sinking feeling, Doug Sisk was known for a sinker ball that devastated opponents. The righty complimented Jesse Orozco brilliantly the year the Mets started to be taken seriously, racking up 15 saves. And Turk Wendell, 1999. Do you know when Turk wasn't available to pitch? Neither did he. Turk was ready to go, whatever the situation. A staff leading 80 times in 1999. And given that the Mets had to clinch their playoff spot in game 163, every slam of the rosin bag proved critical. Hey, let's not forget workhorse Roberto Hernandez from 2005 or game changer until he got peckish Duaner Sanchez from 2006. We shouldn't forget anybody. We're making history here. We're picking the first Met setup man for the All-Star team. Who's going to come out of the pen before the ninth for us?
I wanted to pick Doug Sisk. I'm not a writer like my friend here, but I always thought if I was to write a memoir of my Mets fandom, it would be called I Never Booed Doug Sisk, as many Mets fans did. But recently, there's been a lot of talk about the usage of relief pitchers. He needs to rest. He pitched yesterday. He can't pitch three games in a row. In 2010, it was a wonder when Pedro Feliciano did not enter a game. He was in 92 games, folks. 92 out of 162. It was a surprise when he was not in a game. What a great pitcher he was. I loved watching him, and we got to watch him often. Pedro Feliciano gets my vote.
He was a sweetheart of a man from everything I've been able to gather. Watched him in action, dealing with fans a couple of times up close, and yeah, just a guy you relied on. There's a reason he was Perpetual Pedro, because you wanted him out there. Again, it was a little different game then because you don't have the three batter rule, so you could just bring him in to face that tough lefty, and more often than not, he got that tough lefty. And as we said about Dennis Cook, it was historically not an easy position to fill. And again, I just need to reiterate what incredible outings Larry Bernard had that year. Seven innings, 10 innings, relief in a row. Come on. It's not a full season. It's not even a full half season. But that alone, considering the All-Star game was at Shea Stadium that year, somebody should have found a way to get him on the team. But yeah, you know what? I never booed Doug Sisk either. And I'm the guy who votes for Doug Sisk. I don't think Doug Sisk's Mets career, sort of like what you said about Mackie Sasser earlier, is ever fairly portrayed. Because yeah, he went through some problems and he took way too much grief for it. And you know what? You get to 1986. He's not relied on as much, but he's a good piece of that bullpen. But really, 83 and then 84 in particular, the year we're talking about, huge reason the Mets are suddenly a contender. And again, injuries and whatever else, it came apart. I'm glad he's still out there. Glad he still comes to the reunions. Sounds happy when I hear him interviewed. And I happily vote for him for this slot on our All-Star team. But now at last, we come to the closer. NL All-Star teams have been enriched by Mets who knew how to slam doors. Tug McGraw in 1972. Jesse Orozco in 1983 and 1984. John Franco in 1990. The beloved Armando Benitez in 2003. Billy Wagner in 2007 and 2008. Francisco Rodriguez in 2009. Jairis Familia in 2016. And oh, how we miss him, Edwin Diaz in 2022. Are there any doors left to slam? We're talking Mets in the late innings. You can never protect a lead too much. Our closers loosening up in the pen are Neil Allen, 1980, Not only was Neil emerging as one of the National League's best righty relievers, he was one of the first signature players known to the cadre of fantasists who invented rotisserie, later fantasy baseball. Neil went for $2 in the very first draft en route to putting up 22 saves. What a bargain. Bob Apodaca, 1975. Imagine having to succeed Tug McGraw as the main man coming in from the Shea Stadium bullpen. Dak lived that dream and did it well, notching 13 saves despite missing a month due to injury. Braden Looper, 2004. Looper left the world champion Marlins and never pitched like he was with and also ran, posting 29 saves and making Art Howe's proclamations of "we battled" that much more legitimate. Roger McDowell, 1986. There was a little vulture to the so-called second spitter, swooping up 14 wins in relief for a team that couldn't turn around without going on a 7-game winning streak. But it wasn't just luck that had Rogers save 22 games, one more than his lefty counterpart, Jesse Orosco. And that's before a particularly memorable long afternoon's work in the Astrodome in October. And Randy Myers, 1988, a state-of-the-art intense southpaw, liked to lift weights and dispose of batters, saved 26 games with smoke. Fascinating character. Also of interest, the studious Skip Lockwood, who walked down 19 saves in 1976, and Dr. Ron Taylor, who successfully operated on last batters throughout 1969, the dawn of the respect for relief pitching era, and what a year for a Met pitcher to come through. You got to believe that Tug et al. Should have some company. Who is going to be our retroactive Met All-Star closer?
There was a great movie in 2012 called Looper with Bruce Willis and Joseph Gordon-Levitt. There was a great relief pitcher for the Mets in 2004 named Braden Looper. The Mets got the best out of Braden Looper in his career. He wasn't as good as a Cardinal or a Marlin. He wasn't as good anywhere as he was with the Mets. And in 2004, 29 saves. I think we've forgotten about Braden Looper. We're not forgetting about today. He gets my vote.
Nor should we forget about Braden Looper. When you're done looking up Bobby Ojeda's 1988 peripherals, I urge you to go to the game logs for the 2004 Mets. There's a game in San Francisco on a Saturday in August that it's one of the greatest games the Mets have ever played that nobody besides me ever talks about. Barry Bonds is having one of his Barry Bonds games. David Wright is emerging as if a full-grown butterfly. Crazy back and forth, sun and shadows. And the midst of that, Braden Looper, I think he gives up a run, but like you can't blame him. He comes into like some kind of bases loaded situation, but he holds Bonds at bay. He holds the Giants at bay. He keeps the Mets going. To me, that was the epitome of the Braden Looper year. I'm still sort of sore at him for the next year because he never came clean about an injury he had. And we can be sore about this for Braden Looper, which has not much to do with his Met All-Star credentials, but I'm going to mention it anyway. Braden Looper's a little better for the Cardinals. Like you said, he was never as good again. He's a little better for the Cardinals in 2006. He's closing and not Adam Wainwright in game 7 of the NLCS. But that's not why I'm not picking Braden Looper, because I got to go with Randy Myers. The best closer for one year the Mets may have ever had, at least until Edwin Diaz and maybe September of 73, Tug McGraw. To me, Randy Myers was the closer, state of the art. I think I used that phrase already. Intimidating, threw strikes, just loved watching him. He was crazy. Dressing in the camouflage, the hunting and the fishing. I don't know about the fishing. They all hunt. But there was something. He was like the soldier of fortune of relief pitchers. But that was all kind of sidebar stuff. He was just devastating out there for one year and devastating the second year, actually. And then they trained him for John Franco, who piled up lots of saves and is, again, a huge figure in Mets history and did a lot of great things. But, man, I always missed Randy Myers. And he was coming on by the middle of 88 as one of the best relievers in the league. And it's tough to bypass Roger McDowell here, because even though Roger McDowell isn't in the Mets Hall of Fame, he actually made one of the all-time Met teams when the Mets announced a 40th anniversary team. He was the all-time right-handed reliever, a spot that he didn't get in the 50th anniversary year. I don't know if they did a right-handed, left-handed. So, yeah, we know how huge he was in 86, and he was having a huge season in the middle of that year. And boy, let me tell you something. Neil Allen deserves to be remembered for more than trade bait for Keith Hernandez, and even that fun little nugget about being one of the first rotisserie/fantasy baseball gets. My guy, though, Randy Myers. So we've got our teams.
This was fun. I hope our listeners liked it. And if they liked it or whether they disagree with our selections, let us know at nationalleaguetown@gmail.com.
Yeah, definitely tell us if you have a player who not only we didn't pick, that we didn't even mention. I went through all the previous Met All-Stars just so you'd be clear that we tried to keep everybody in mind. I hate being told you forgot, but it's quite possible I forgot or we forgot. There are a lot of Mets out there. And yeah, a few of these picks were, to invoke the phrase again, flights of fancy. And we're quite aware that when they put together all-star teams in a given year, every team in the league has to be represented and somebody is inevitably squeezed out unfairly. But you know, that's part of what we're addressing, the unfairly part. And again, as Jeff's put it before, his favorite sport is Mets baseball, more so than baseball. So we necessarily take the Metsian angle. So congratulations to not just the players, who I'm sure are all sitting around listening to this. Congratulations to our memories, I want to say. Congratulations to the fact that we've kept these guys in our minds and in our hearts all these years. That was the great part of the All-Star game when you were a kid. I hope it's still great for kids today. It's never going to mean as much to us as adults at this stage of our lives. But I hope, in some perverted sense, that there is some kid who was 12, we'll say, in 2017, who also remembers Jay Bruce being snubbed and is still mad about it decades later. Not that I'm wishing anybody be consumed by disgust as their life goes on, but this is the sort of thing that should stay with you. Just as it should stay with you that Lee Mazzilli hit a home run in 1979 and then Joel Youngblood got an at bat in 1981 and all the wonder that goes into your team being recognized. So that was just kind of the thought process behind this. And you're going to have a lot of people telling you who should be on an all-star team. You'll even have a lot of people telling you who should be the all-time Mets team. I doubt you're going to have too many people telling you who should make up a team of would-be Met All-Stars, but what the hell? It's a long season, especially this one. Let's have some fun. I hope you've had some fun with us.
We'll be back next week with another episode of National League Town. We thank you for listening. Until next week, I'm Jeff Heisen.
I still resent Walter Alston for not picking Del Unser in 1975. I'm Greg Prince.
And as always, let's go Mets. Copyright 2023, music provided by the Royal Arctic Institute. Check them out on Spotify.